Hey, Houston. For a limited time at VisionWorks, you can get two complete pairs of glasses. Frames, lenses, the works, for just $49 on single vision glasses and $89 on progressives. And that's a good deal. But we offer that pricing on over 500 frames, which makes it a great deal. Right now, buy two complete pairs of single vision glasses for just $49 or two pairs of progressives for only $89. VisionWorks, we're here to help you. Some restrictions apply. See store for details. Offer expires November 10th.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is Conversation with My Shoes.
On the World Wide Web, 60 minutes of inspirational guests from around the world.
Mission Unstoppable.
Guerrilla Coach Frankie Picasso is a rebel with a cause.
You
live life on Mission Unstoppable, and every day is an adventure. Here she is, Frankie Picasso,
with Mission Unstoppable. Mission Unstoppable.
Mission Unstoppable.
Hello there, this is the Unstoppable Coach, Frankie Picasso, and you are about to go on Mission Unstoppable. Today you're going to meet an incredible man who accomplished a monumental feat. Like most of us, he was an extraordinary being living an ordinary existence, until one day he could no longer avoid waking up to his purpose. My guest today is a man who went through a true metamorphosis. The time had come for him to emerge as his true self. And like any metamorphosis, it wasn't easy. It had many moments of anguish and pain, but along with those growing pains came moments of absolute brilliance and a knowing that he would never return to be who he was before. We all have the capacity to accomplish the impossible, to move the unmovable, but at times it does come with personal sacrifice, some not everyone is willing to make. I know it wasn't easy for my guest, but the sacrifice was one he was willing to make. And my guest today knows all about being unstoppable. To you and I, his name is Kevin, but to 1,000 orphans in Africa, he is a superhero. He is the Banana Man. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, Frankie. Thank you
How are you?
For inviting me on the show. I'm fine.
Oh, more than welcome. You are the Banana Man, and you feed the starving children of Zululand.
I do.
You do. How many thousands of pounds of fruit do you serve in a year?
How much does it cost? It actually depends on the rand rate, which actually changes quite a bit from different times of the year. It actually only costs me 4p a day to feed a child, which I don't know how that converts into Canadian dollars, but it costs me £40 a day to feed 1,000 children, which is
£40 a day.
Only £40 a day to feed 1,000 children. That's okay, probably about $80.
That's right. It's about $80.
Yeah.
Now, you have a book, The Banana Man, and it's
for sale.
And it's for sale on Amazon. And I'm going to let you tell folks how to find that. But what I'd like to do today is to challenge anyone who is listening to purchase your book, because with every book, a child gets fed for a month.
Yeah.
So let's feed the kids.
Yeah.
Come on. Tell them how to get there.
Okay, the book has just come out by Academy Press, and you can effectively buy that on the Amazon store online. And if you go onto Amazon and click through and put in the title Banana Man, you'll see my book, which comes up, and that can be purchased for $9.99 in the UK, which is probably around $20 in Canada. All the royalties and profits from the book go direct to the charity, and each book sold feeds at least one child for a month, which was the whole purpose of writing the book and telling the story.
Now, this is a fairly big book. I read the book. It's about 200 and some odd pages.
Yep.
It is a fascinating tale. It was engrossing reading. I couldn't put it down for a second. So I will tell you that you're going to get value for your money if you do purchase this book beyond feeding these kids. I don't want, to give too much away, but at the same time, we want to talk about what you were doing. So let's talk about that night. I guess it was, how many years ago now?
It was 2.5 years ago. It was
two
back
and a half
in February.
Years ago.
Yeah, 2005.
when your wife went out, the kids were with her, you were sitting home alone, you had no little slaves to turn the channel for you, you didn't have the clicker in your hand, and like most men, were too lazy to get up.
Correct.
So what came on the TV was a documentary about the AIDS orphans, or Africa, or something like that, right?
Yep.
And you became engrossed in this show.
I'd only been watching it for a couple of minutes, and as I sat there and watched, I just watched a young boy witness his father die in front of his eyes of AIDS. The program told us that his mum had died a year earlier, and this young boy was left on his own and sent to walk miles back home to a filthy mud hut with no electricity or gas or running water. He had no food. And very quickly, he just broke down, and right there and then, I knew this young guy was going to die, but he was still alive, and I just couldn't accept that in a few days' time or a few weeks' time, this young boy named Snee would be dead, and it really, really just upset me like nothing ever has before, and really, the story goes on from there.
Had you ever felt that kind of emotion about anything before?
No, and this is the strange part. And I think when you read the book, people are saying now it's an incredibly inspirational book. And I think it's because of the fact that I'm such an ordinary person, as you read in the book. I had no money. I just had a job. I had an ordinary life with my wife and two young children of my own. And yet within 24 hours, my life was turned on its head. I took all my life savings and just knew I had to go and find this young boy. 6 days later, I'd taken three planes across from the UK to Paris. Then I had to fly into Johannesburg, and then I flew to Durban. And I landed in Durban and didn't have a clue where I was or where I was going. I just knew I had to find Zululand and find this young boy and help him.
I mean, can you imagine going to this place? You'd never been there before. You didn't know where you were going. All you knew is that this child is out there somewhere in Zululand, in a mud hut. You know, it's like there wasn't like there was going to be street signs saying this is where Snee lives.
Yeah.
Was there a time, any time when you looked into yourself and said, "What the heck am I doing?"
It's very, very difficult for people to understand this if they haven't experienced it. So all I can do is try and put people into my mindset. If your child now was away from you in another continent, in another area, and was in trouble and was going to die, what would you not do to find them? And
right.
And that was what was flowing through every cell in my body. You know, I don't know why I connected with this young boy, but it was as if it was my own son, and nothing on this planet was going to stop me trying to track him down. And it really, I look back now and think, what was I doing? But at the time, nothing could have stopped me. Nothing could have stopped me from trying to track him down and help this young boy.
Even your own children couldn't stop you.
I couldn't look them in the eye, Frankie. I was looking at my own children and trying to speak to them after I'd seen this TV program. And I was looking at them thinking, I'm going to let a child die if I don't go. You know, nothing could stop me. I just, when something like that happens to you, it's that profound that, you know, every cell in your body just says, you must go and do this now. And after that, everything just takes a life of its own. You know, as I was watching the TV program, you've read the book and it says in the book, I was watching the TV program and I'm not religious at all, and I hope I don't upset any of your listeners when I say this, but I was that upset at what I was seeing, I found myself arguing with God. You know, I don't pray, but that night I did, and I was saying, why on earth do you let this happen? And a voice came back into my head, just my own conscience, and said, why do you? Mm-hmm. And instantly there and then, I knew that I could do something about it, and I knew I couldn't let this carry on. And 6 days later, I was in Zululand trying to track down this young boy.
That's amazing. I know that I've often, you know, felt how fortunate I am, my children are, to have been born on this continent, know, rather than in Africa or, you know, in places like Bangladesh where there's always an earthquake or something horrible happens to them all the time. It's like, what did they do to be born over there? You know, I mean, by the grace of God, go I.
Well, we all live our own lives, and before that point in time, I lived my own life, and I'd seen lots of things on TV, and I'd never, you know, I'd watch something and think that's sad, and then turn over and move on. But some point in your life, these things come in a different way, and you have to really make a decision on what you're going to do, and it took, the hardest part of everything I've done in the last 2.5 years was that night, getting over the inhibition to just get up and go and leave all my family, leave my work, leave my friends all behind and just go. You know, that
you cleaned out your bank account.
Sorry?
You cleaned out your bank account to go.
I'd lost the business about a year or two before, and we were in debt. We had very little money. I literally had to say to my wife, look, I'm taking our life savings here and to get a flight. It left me with little money after that, I thought, at that point in time, after I paid for the flight. But magically, I walked into a third world economy with a few hundred pounds, and it multiplied tenfold. All of a sudden, I was a very rich man and could do amazing things. But I left home with what I thought was very, very little money. I didn't even have a credit card. You know, I had nothing.
What kind of work did you do before?
I was then, and I am now, a bookkeeper. I do bookkeeping and VAT, payroll, things like that.
Oh, okay. All right. So you're now currently working again?
I still do that for my own living, but I took on a part-time job for a couple of years as well, just to keep feeding the 1,000 kids a day that I'd set up the schemes for. So I've been working a part-time job for a couple of years too. But having been out there, I've also tried to take hold of my own destiny and say, you know, get a track of my own life, and I've started to try and be more entrepreneurial and do things that I want to do as well now. So I'm hoping in the future I'll be able to take another leap of faith and, you know, leave the bookkeeping behind and move on to things that make sense to me as well.
Right. Well, you know, you're running a charity, I guess. You really were a one-man army. Or are you still a one-man army? I mean, I know that you had the nuns helping, but you had this incredible guilt. You know, like you didn't want to eat food because the kids weren't eating. And yet, you know, you needed your strength. And where do you think that guilt came from? I mean, years and years of...
It's very difficult to say. When you're in the guilt is really when you're there, in their environment. And when I was in Zululand, I couldn't eat. I lost a lot of weight in a week. And it was really, it wasn't out of guilt, it was out of anger. Why should I eat when there's children around me going hungry? And to be honest with you, I walk back into Zululand, and I hope to go back there soon. When I'm in that environment, I won't eat. Just out of annoyance, out of anger at the world, how we have so much in our normal day. And yet right here, right now, this very moment as we speak, there's a child going hungry. And not just one, millions of them. And it doesn't need to be. It doesn't need to be at all. It takes so little to stop it. I don't run a charity. I was a one-man army, I suppose, for about 2.5 years, until February this year, when a charity adopted what I'd done after they heard my story. So they've now... taken on my work within their charity and are helping me. But for 2 years, I worked on my own and fed 400,000 school meals to young, hungry children in Zululand, South Africa, without any fundraising. And if I can do that, what can we do when we come together? You know.
Oh, amazing. Like, did you ever think, I mean, just a dollar from everybody in the world, you know, nobody'd be hungry. It's so phenomenally easy to feed, you know, these children. And they're so lost. I mean, in 2 years, there's going to be 4.5 million orphans in Africa.
Yeah.
70% of that country is dying of AIDS.
Yeah.
You know, it's a crisis situation. But nobody wants to hear about AIDS anymore. Nobody wants to hear about it. And I think, you know, today or yesterday, the most amazing thing, I'm sorry, I have to mention it because it just blew my mind. The Archbishop, the head of the Catholic Church, in Africa said that they stated that the European condoms contained the AIDS virus and that it was a plan by the world to wipe out the African people and that the antiviral drugs were also tainted. The country fights it. They fight having safe sex. They fight, you know, saying that they have AIDS. They would rather put down tuberculosis on a death certificate than AIDS.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. But can I take both of those points? There's about 3 points there.
Yeah, please.
Up, and I'll speak to you about them all one at a time. Number one, there's no crisis. It's not a crisis. It's a crime. There's no crisis going on. It's a crime against humanity. No child on this planet needs to go hungry, full stop. Where I go in Zululand, there are hungry children. Yet to get into Zululand, I have to drive through an area called the Banana Belt because there's millions of hectares of land, prime growing land, where fruit is grown. That food isn't given to hungry children with no money. It is taken away in the opposite direction to the ports and shipped around the world. So there isn't a lack of food in the area where I feed these children. In fact, the only reason I can feed them is because there's so much and it's so cheap, so affordable. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. The second thing is, and the Archbishop, I've got no intention of moving into politics or into religion as a talk. I will just talk to you from my own experience.
Sure.
What you've got on the ground, you then have AIDS on the ground, which again, there is no reason why in South Africa anybody is dying of AIDS. In South Africa today, you have 1.1 million AIDS orphans, and yet there are drugs available today that can extend the life of anybody with HIV indefinitely. So nobody on this planet needs to die of AIDS. They only do because of money. They only go hungry because of money. So there's no issues there. With regard to condoms, how can you expect a person who has no money to feed themselves or any money to live and lives in the middle of Africa where there are there's no shops there, there's nothing there, there's no vending machines where you can go and buy condoms, so it really doesn't matter anyway. You know, when you walk into Zululand, there isn't a shop that sells condoms or a chemist where there's condoms. You're talking about a very rural, sparse area with lots of people spread out over a long distance. They are hungry and impoverished, and even if you could buy condoms for 2p each, you wouldn't because you would go hungry. So it's the last thing that you're ever going to do. I've also heard that with condoms as well, the AIDS virus is so small it can actually slip through the condom. The fibre of the condom isn't protective enough against this virus. So I'm not sure that it's as effective as people think anyway, but I'm no expert on this.
Right.
And there's many, many issues. I don't think it's the African people themselves who are putting up blocks against what's going on. When you're on the ground, you can see quite clearly there is no reason in South Africa why the government does not feed its own people or does not provide them with medicine.
Right.
And I think that is the problem, that the governments of the world do not take responsibility for the problems of the world. If we took responsibility as individuals, as governments, and as churches, we would have nobody dying of AIDS, we would have nobody going hungry. And really, we've got to look at ourselves in deep, deep shame that we allow these things to continue to happen. And, you know, I find it as simple as that, to be honest with you, which is why I do what I do.
Right. I know that there was a geologist who discovered that selenium was and can be used to reverse the effects of the AIDS virus. In fact, you can take somebody off their deathbed and have them walking around again. That was just proven by the University of Miami last year. And for about 2 cents a day, you know, we're talking a salt tablet, for about 2 cents a day, we can have these people, these parents of these children up, you know, not healthy, not, I mean, they still have the AIDS virus, but they can go back to work, they can live, they can look after their children.
Yeah.
You're right, it is criminal. It is a crime.
Yeah. And the only reason that these products don't come out is because there's no money. You know, the drug companies do not want a cure to AIDS. They want something that you can sell for the lifetime of somebody being infected. And again, it's a crime. It's all about money. There's nothing happening today that can't be stopped. But we have to stand up and say, enough, this is it. We're not happy with this. It doesn't need to continue. We're going to stop it. And I'm afraid we need to stand up one at a time and then come together and then things will stop. But when we just see things on TV and then turn over and go back to our ordinary lives, as I sometimes wish I could, believe me, these things will continue. You know, it's really, really up to us. And the third point that you made before, if I can just come back on it, is that the governments do want to put that these people have died of TB. In fact, they don't want to even acknowledge that they've died at all. They're not even registered. These people are living in mud huts. They're not on a database somewhere that they even exist. If you acknowledge that they've died of AIDS, or if you acknowledge they exist, you have to do something about it. And they would prefer that they didn't. Most people who die of AIDS quietly in a mud hut, out of sight, out of mind, out of the focus of the world.
On the Eastern Cape, I heard today that there are people who are so poor and sick and dying that they're being eaten by rats alive because they can't even be taken into the hospitals. I mean, that is horrendous.
Yeah.
Absolutely horrendous. The situation, I mean, it boggles the mind, but it is absolutely sickening. Now, I also heard that children, orphans, are being fed non-food soup. So it's sawdust. They're being fed sawdust soup, which, again, would you want your children to eat this? So please go to Amazon.com. Please buy Kevin's book, Feed a Child for a Month, because I don't want to know about any kid eating food soup, you know, this non-food soup. In a country, like you said, that is lush with vegetation, the fruit is there.
You know, one of the hardest things I found when I was over there, Frankie, was, I don't know if you remember the story about within the book about the young guy who'd broken into the farm to try and steal honey.
Yes, I was going to mention that story, yes. And you know, argued with a nun about, you would steal food for your children, and she looked at you like, that's against the Bible. And your argument was, but food, God grows food, so that's our food. It doesn't belong to anybody.
Absolutely. I mean, the farmers will shoot the children dead for stealing food. You know, that's the seriousness. Life is so precious. It's so amazing, and yet it's treated so cheaply. You know, and you've got children of 8 and 9 who are starving hungry. They have absolutely no choice but to steal food or do child labor work, which is prostitution, and then they catch AIDS and die anyway, or beg. You know,
how young are the children who are prostituting themselves?
Frankie, there are children there from babies upwards who are orphans, you know, and you've got 1.1 million AIDS orphans. That means anybody from the age of 1 day old through to 17 and 18 where they can take care of themselves fit within that 1.1 million AIDS orphans within South Africa. So to ask me how many, who knows?
No, I said how young are the children?
How young? These kids aren't just doing prostitution. They are open to abuse. You know, if you've got a four-year-old living in a hut, it's a mud hut with no door on and no protection, you know, there's bad things happening there in a society that's in meltdown and in crisis.
Yeah.
So whether you've got a four-year-old doing prostitution or not, they are still sexually abused or open to the potential of sexual abuse. You know, it's an incredibly, people say to me, and you said it before, very inspirational. I don't feel that at all. I feel very, very depressed because about what I do, because of what I see and what I have to try and mentally deal with day to day and cope with, knowing that while I'm here now on the phone talking to you and to your listeners, I'm not standing in Zululand protecting children. And that's a horrible conflict that's within my life every day now. You know, to still want to be happy, I have to spend time with my family. I have to have a life in the UK where I live. But at the same time, why am I here? Why am I not there? You know, I could jump on a plane. I've broken the inhibition now. You know, there's nothing holding me back. I can jump on a plane. I can walk into Zululand tomorrow. I can feed kids and they'll live. I can protect children, you know, and it's a difficult thing to cope with.
You have a background in martial arts.
I do indeed. Yeah.
And yet, of course, there's all sorts of ways to get hurt. But you went to Africa many times with fear, with a great fear that you were going to die.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Where did that come from?
From the stomach up, believe me. The first time I went, there was no fear because I simply was a man on a mission to find a child. And you really, unless you've been in my shoes, you can't understand that there was just absolutely nothing going to stop me at that point in time. And indeed, it didn't. And I found a young boy. But having found him and been in that area on the night I arrived in Nkandla, the town that I went into, I had guns put in my face. I had people try and drive me off the road, you know. And at the time, you're on a roller coaster ride going forward, and you don't realize what's happening around you. It's only when you look back you think, "Whoa, hold on, that wasn't too clever." And you know, it's the second time you go in, the third time you go in. When you go back again, you know what you're walking into.
Right.
So the first time I went in, it was almost ignorance is bliss. You know, nothing touched me because I had no fear. Now I'm scared of my own fear when nothing actually happens to me. You know? So
I can understand that.
Yeah.
It's
the nerves. It's the worst part of the journey is when I leave home and leave my family behind and drive to the airport. And I usually spend the next 2 hours in the toilets being sick before I get on the plane.
Oh, my gosh.
And then after that, my mentality changes. My attitude to the world changes. I leave everything behind.
You become a superhero.
No, I focus on what is going to happen over the next few days, which is magic. Mm-hmm. I know that I will just walk down a road or travel down a road and see a child who's hungry and just give them a banana. You know, sounds incredibly stupid to you and me, but if you've not ate anything for a day and a half, that's a lot of food, and you're very, very grateful. And I'll do that 1,000 times in a day. You know, I'll feed. I just feed thousands of kids. You know, and that's what I do. And it's an incredibly magical experience for me. You know, I'll live more in 24 hours than I have in the other 36 years of my life. Just doing that type of thing, you know, to see a desperate child and make them smile, to give a kid in need of love a hug, you know, to see a dying mum and just make a laugh for a minute, it blows your mind, you know, it blows your mind. When I'm there, I'm the happiest person on the planet. It's only when I walk back away and leave these kids and these people to it that, you know, the sadness sinks back in.
What do you think, how are you going to deal with this rage that you feel when you leave?
You know, it was incredibly difficult for the first 6 months. I nearly had a nervous breakdown, I think. When I came back out of South Africa the first time, I was psychotic. More than capable of throwing my weight around, and you know, there were people in the airport that you will have read that were really getting on my case, and I really nearly hurt somebody. And I've learned to take things in balance now and really accept my role in what I'm doing, which is, you know, I didn't want any of this, Frankie. I haven't tried to do any of the things that have happened. I simply broke an inhibition one night, and I went to save a child. And that was it. That's all I ever went to do. But when I got there, I found thousands more who needed help. After that, it was just maddening to see how little it took to help them. So, as you know, I came back home quickly. All these amazing things happened, and I sold my house, which released a lot of money, rented a beautiful home, which I still live in today. And was able to go back to Zululand 12 weeks after I first walked in with a lot of money and set up food to school schemes, which has fed, you know, 400,000 kids to date and feeds another 1,000 every day at the moment. But it's tough, you know, trying to get into your mind and that anger, and it really is anger, you know, that there's, if your child was dying today, Frankie, and there was something you could do about it, but you can't do it, one of the biggest emotions you would have would be anger. And that's
right.
How I feel a millionfold.
But you're not angry for one child. You're angry for all the children.
I feed 1,000 kids a day.
I know.
I don't care about that. I know that I don't feed another 10,000 who are starving. And
right.
It drives me nuts. What am I supposed to do? You know,
isn't it amazing, though, that you just woke up? Like, I mean, you actually, like, this was divine intervention. I have no doubt that you, you know, were, I don't want, significantly awoken by, you know, the universe to go off and do this. You had many signposts along the way. It was incredible.
That part of the story I still find trouble to deal with today. You know, I really do. And when
you still don't believe in the universe?
yeah, I do, but I find it weird as well, and I argue with it a lot, and I think it argues back, and this is why I get sent to do these things. You know, I've probably had 10 prayers in my life, and all of them have been telling God exactly what I think of him and what he should be doing, and he just says, hey, hold on, you go and do it then.
You're the only person who has yelled at God and said, why do you let these atrocities happen?
You know, the first time when I went into Zululand and came out, I felt so isolated and so alone. All these amazing signs, as you said, had come in. And I thought, why me? Why is this happening to me? I'm just an ordinary person. I don't even go to church. Why is this happening to me? But now I realize it's happening to somebody every day. I think that's the magic. You know, every single day, what I went through 2.5 years ago is happening to somebody now. And if anything bizarre or weird is going on in your life, buy a copy of the book and read it. Not to feed the child for the month, which it does, just so you know you're not alone, because it's a horrible experience. You know, all these signs were coming into me. How does one man in deep debt with no money, who can't find his way from one end of town to another, find a child in the middle of Zululand, in the middle of valleys? I had absolutely no right on this planet to find this child. Find this child, help him, and then be able to come back. And 12 weeks after I've spent all my life savings at that point, I haven't got a penny to my name, I'm able to come back home. Within 12 weeks, I'm living in a fantastic house, even though I don't own it, because I've been asked to babysit this incredible house that I live in even today.
Well, this is the law of attraction at work. This is how the law of attraction works. So, you know, if you've read The Secret, you've got to read Banana Man, because this is what they're talking about. And I don't want to give too much of the book away, because it's such a fun book to read, you know. But I think that they can already tell how amazing it is. And you know what I think is incredible, Kevin, is that those who have the least amount to give, give the most.
You know, Frankie, can I say something there? Can I tell you what
please.
I do with 4P? And this is what blows me away today. And again, all these things happen by accident. I don't take credit for any of these. These things were completely out of my hands, believe me. I realized that I could only feed children en masse if I fed them in school.
Mm-hmm.
So I set up food to school schemes. And I was paying 4p a day to feed children. Now, I hadn't realized at the time, but what that did was that 4p didn't just feed them. It made them go to school. Because if there was no food at school, they would have to go out and beg or do prostitution, or they had no reason to go to school. So the 4P not only feeds them, but it gets them into school. The school provides them with social structure and an education, which gives them half a chance of a better future. Because now they don't need to beg or do prostitution, it moves them away from AIDS. All for 4P, this is. So for 4P, I've fed them. I've taken them into school to get them an education. I've removed them away from AIDS, which obviously improves the mental health, the physical health, their emotional health. And that 4P I spend with the local traders and the local fruit growers, so I'm pumping money into the economy. Now, I only put £40 a day, $80 Canadian dollars a day into the economy. But in a third world economy, that's like putting $800, $1,000 a day in. Because it's not the same value as it is to me and you. Money over there is worth a tremendous amount more. Your Canadian dollar can do 10 times more in the third world economy than it can in Canada, if you understand that. But that money stays within the economy as well. That 80 Canadian dollars that I was putting in a day 2.5 years ago is still magically floating around that economy. These people can't save money. They can't travel out of the area. So $80 I put into the area in June 2005 to traders, they then spend it with another trader who spends it with another trader. And it's floating around the economy.
Right.
And don't forget,
Kevin,
this is all.
Let me stop you for 1 second. I want to see if anybody wants to talk to Kevin. I'm sorry. Call him at 646-595-3741. We're ready to take your call. If you want to give him a shout, that'd be great. 646-595-3741. And maybe you want to give us a call and talk to Kevin yourself personally. You're right. That money is still floating around. And do you know what I read today in the BBC?
Yep.
What they are doing with condoms today is that the army in the Congo is giving it to the, you know, the guys in the army and showing them how to put a condom on by using
right.
banana.
Yeah.
So that's what bananas are going to say. The army is teaching them how to put on a condom. I love it.
Cool.
Okay. I know that you know, many years ago I was in the condom business, and I did try to send condoms to Africa because I was buying them at around 4 cents on the world market.
Right.
I heard that they were being, you know, charged about $5 in the towns. And
yep.
of course, you know, people who make no money can't afford, you know, a $5 condom, but
yep.
they were 4 cents. And they are being given out by the government. Some of them are being given out in public places, but I also know that there's only enough there for a man to have safe sex 6 times a year. So,
right.
Yeah, that's true. Pretty pitiful.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you think it's 4 cents, they're very, very cheap. And you can probably get them for even less than I could buy them for, because I wasn't buying mountains and mountains, you know?
Right, yeah.
So,
yeah. And what do these things cost to make? You know, if you're buying them, there's somebody out there in South Africa who is making these for less
Malaysia,
than 4 cents.
Malaysia, or,
they can
yeah.
just dump them into these economies and help these people.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. But you see, there's also social practices there. Now, in Kenya, you know, for a wife, if she, you know, if her husband says, you know, I want you to have sex with my friend and it's a peer, then she's supposed to do that. It's like, come over and have a drink.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I
was born in the wrong country. No, I mean, within all of these cultures, they have their own way of working. And what I found within Zululand is that they rely heavily on the witch doctors.
Yeah.
But when I first looked at this, I thought, this is awful. These witch doctors are doing all these crazy things that I don't understand, but I know they're not beneficial. And I realized over a period of time that a lot of what they do is out of desperation, for one. You know, the witch doctors don't have access to anti-AIDS drugs, so they're going to have to say, look, this plant or this herb will help you. But what they do en masse is provide a massive social placebo pill. Where, okay, there are a lot of people dying of AIDS, but they trust deeply in the witch doctors. They go to them. The witch doctors say, take this, take that, you'll be fine. The people go away. And the placebo pill effect has uplifted their spirits. Even if it
yeah.
hasn't cured them in any way, they're curing themselves through happiness, through self-improvement mentally. They are boosting their own inner self, which is helping their immune systems. And, you know, if you've got somebody dying and they're going to last the same amount of time, I would much prefer to see them happy, you know,
right.
and uplifted and feeling that they're on a path to wellness than constantly depressed that they're ill and feeling sick. And, you know, I think that the cultures there do have strange things that we find difficult to accept, and we think they compound the problem. But in a way, they have no choice to do these things. And they do help on a grassroots level. They do help. I'm not saying that the sexual activities that you were talking about before, where it can encourage the spread of AIDS, that happens as well. You know, Zululand, the Zulus are quite sexist, or I don't know whether that's the correct terminology from their point of view. They quite have a social order where the male is dominant, and the female is subordinate within the family, and that's their culture, and it doesn't help in terms of the spread of AIDS. But, you know, having said that, the culture is just being eliminated. You know, I really believe in 30 years' time, the rural Zulus in Natal risk being extinct. You know, the majority of them now are children. Anybody who is sexually active through to old age will have AIDS and will be dying. And you have a really now society of elderly grandparents who aren't sexually active, so aren't catching AIDS,
right.
and young children who will catch AIDS and die out. And I really,
you know, it's
fear.
It's interesting when you say that, because I just had this thought that you've got these 4.5 million children, and Zulu is the children of God. And
Zulu,
these truly are children of God, aren't they?
Yeah.
They really
yeah.
are. I mean, they're left in the hands of people like you and people who are going to hopefully buy your book today and help feed these kids. So they really are children of God. There's a lady, you know, in Africa, you know, we hear about the village raises the child. And there's a woman in your book. I can't, is her name, was it Lily? I can't remember
Lindy
how.
Lindy Wee. Lindy Wee.
And she you know, she has 13 kids, not her own. All of them, who she's brought, taken in because of AIDS, and she has AIDS herself. She's dying. Is she still alive?
She's still alive, and I'm not religious, again, by the grace of God, and because of the Catholic nuns who are out there who actually look after her and really uplift her spirit. Lindy Wee believes that the nuns will look after her, that people like myself will look after her children, and that lifts the spirit. You don't need to do anything more for these people. It doesn't cost a penny. If they believe somebody cares about them, somebody will help them, that they're not alone, that when they die, their children aren't going to fall by the wayside, you will pick up these people's spirits, and they will fight to live, you know. And Lindy Wee is alive today because of 10 incredible nuns who pray for her every day and uplift her spirit every day and you know, really just give her life back after it's been stolen away. You know, and I've seen the power of hope within the eyes of people like Lindy Wee. All you need to do is pick these people up and give them a little hope, and they will fight. They will fight. They really will.
Doesn't what did it feel
power.
Like to you to sit in her hut and know that Sir Elton John had sat there 2 weeks prior?
You know what? The publishers of the book took out a few of my comments.
I heard you might fight by a CD again.
Yeah, you know, I find it very, very difficult to... I need to raise £40,000 to feed 1 million school meals to hungry children in Zululand. And good God, do they need it, you know. And yet, in my within a 10-minute drive of where I am, there will be people in where I live with a car worth more than that, and it really, really hurts me to my boots when I see these things and realise how disconnected we are from each other. These are children, you know. You said it before. Zulu means literally children of God. And you said these Zulu children are children of God as well. But, and without getting into a political debate or a religious debate, in my view, it's black and white. There either is a God or there is not. If there is a God, we are all his children. And yet we leave these children to starve. You, us, and when I say you, I mean humanity.
No, I don't
we see. Leave children of God to die of hunger when there's absolutely no reason to, you know. And I'm not saying there is or there isn't a God, but if you believe there is, then everybody on this planet is a child of him or created by him, and we leave them to die, you know. And then you go on to people like Elton John, who went into the same area as I did a week or two before and walked into the hut of the same people that I've seen and walked back out again. you know, how discontent, and I'm not saying it's because he didn't want to do anything. You know, Elton John has raised through his charity hundreds of millions of pounds or hundreds of millions of dollars to help people. So he is an amazing man who will do more than I ever can,
right.
Number one. Yet he was so disconnected on the ground that he didn't do anything when it was right in front of him. And I think that's the way a lot of us are, where we really do so much in our own ways, and yet we're so disconnected at the same time from the reality of what's going on. It's somewhere else. It's another problem. There's nothing we can do. It's not really anything that we should be doing something about. It's for the charities. It's for the churches. It's for the rich people. It's for the government. And we take away the responsibility of ourselves. Now, if you're a child of God, Frankie, or if I am, or any of the listeners are, if they believe that because they believe there's a God, then believe me, that responsibility comes way straight back to us. If we're children of God, we can do anything. We can do anything we want. And, you know, I'm not saying I understand it or agree with it, but it amazes me, some of the things that I've done. And I don't understand how they've happened, you know. And we can do anything with desire. And all you need is the desire. And before that comes, you are so disconnected. And it breaks my heart, you know, to see people like Elton John, who does incredible things. He really does do incredible things. And yet, at the same time, so disconnected. And I don't know how you explain that. I really don't.
What was it like when you flew into Durban? When you saw, I guess, immense wealth and incredible poverty, I know how it affected you, but like, what were your thoughts? Like, could you reconcile it at all? Do you want to go banging on all those doors and go, give us money, come on, feed these kids?
Yeah, it was.
Are they aware? Do you think they're even aware of it?
I don't. I really don't. But, you know, I've had South Africans shout at me and say, you shouldn't say this. This is incorrect. We do this. We do the other. And I can only say things from my perspective, from my experience. So I don't try and say anything as a fact. I can only say anything from my perspective and my experience. Because I am sure there are a tremendous amount of people within South Africa doing a tremendous amount of things to help people. But when I flew in, my experience and my feelings at that time were, what on earth am I doing here in this country? I have just taken my life savings. I've come from a small terraced house in a rough part of Merseyside. I have no money. I haven't got a bloody clue where I am or what I'm doing here. And yet there's people here with huge houses, big Mercedes cars, you know, more wealth than I've got back in my own country, and they are right next to children who are going hungry. And to this day, I cannot reconcile that in my mind. I cannot see how you are so disconnected from what is around you when there is a child hungry in front of your door, which is what happens there. You must be able to see what's going on. And, you know, you must wake up to what's happening in your in your country now. In Canada now, Frankie, if you had 1.1 million AIDS orphans in your country, the alarm bells must be ringing. If you had millions of children left homeless with nobody to look after them, hungry every day, alarm bells would start ringing, full stop. And that's how I see it in my experience.
What would you like people to do, Kevin? Oh, we have another caller. Just a moment. Let's bring him up. Hello there. You're on air.
Hello, Frank. It's Erwin calling here.
Hi, Erwin. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm just... I hear... Is he continuing talking?
Yep.
Hello.
Because we're on air.
Hello, Kevin. No, it's quite strange because the frame is coming a little bit later, but I'm really interested in what you're talking about, and I'm... And I just wanted, my question is, how do you organize yourself down on the floor down there? Because, well, on the floor, I mean, in South Africa, because you're still in England, And do you have people working for you or helping you out on there in South Africa? How does it go? Because I think you cannot run it on your own.
Yep. The magic of what I've done is has been forced to happen out of circumstance. When I first walked in there, I had no money. I had nothing. And I'm obviously not a big charity. I don't have a big network of people. But what I realized very, very quickly was that the schools are there where the kids, I could feed the kids. There was a tremendous amount of food there, but nobody could afford it, so it wasn't going to the children. There's hungry children, so and I can only feed them en masse in the schools. And then I have a base of 10 incredible nuns who are desperate to do anything they can, but incredibly impoverished with no money of their own. And what I've done is I've set up the scheme with the nuns and the schools and the local traders. So all I've done is utilized everything that was on the ground. And every month I send money to the nuns, and they administer the food to school schemes that I've set up. And what they do is they buy the fruit from the traders every week, and the traders take it into the schools, and the schools then disperse all the fruit to the kids. So there's absolutely no cost for me other than buying the fruit from the local traders, and everything just falls into place magically. There's no people on the ground or employees or anything like that. What I've got is the school, the people who work in the school, the teachers are obviously delighted that, somebody's helping and there's food going in, and very, very happy to, disperse it to the children. The traders are incredibly grateful that somebody's buying food from them, so they're happy. And the nuns administrate it all for free. So the only thing I have to pay for, apart from about £20 bank charges to send the money across, is the food.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. How many square miles do you think this goes in Zululand? Like, how far is your reach to feed children?
The reach now, I keep trying to tell you about the magic of what's going on when somebody takes an action. And the 4P, and I was trying to tell you before what I do for 4P, it's far more profound than what you think of just feeding a child. One of the biggest things I've done, Frankie, in the last 2 years is become a complete embarrassment. I've become an embarrassment to the big charities that work in South Africa, and I've become a complete embarrassment to the government. And the magic of what I've done is that the charities have come into the area and said, hey, who's this idiot? How can he feed 1,000 kids a day and get them educated and do trade with these local traders and bring them out of prostitution? He can't do this. We're the people who are supposed to be here doing all this good. And the same with the government. And now the government and large charities have moved into the area as well and said, well, that idiot can't do that without us doing it. And charities have moved in, and they're feeding about 4,000 children a day. And the government have moved in, and they're feeding thousands of children a day. So even though I feed 1,000 a day, there's probably 6,000 or 7,000 children being fed every day because I got off my arse 2.5 years ago and took a journey of discovery and, you know, into the middle of nowhere. And how far it reaches, I think it's just going to ripple out. You know, as people see the simplicity of this and how easy it is, I think the charities and the governments are forced to take action and say, yes, this is so obvious, so simple, let's go and do it. And I hope it just ripples out across South Africa and beyond. And people go, yeah, let's feed kids in school. It gets them into school. It gets them educated. It brings them away from the social problems outside of school. We can then do trade with the locals, and it creates magic.
What can we do to take the guilt off of your shoulders?
There's no
I like to do that. I feel bad. You know, you don't feel guilty. Look at all you've accomplished. You have to feel proud of what you've accomplished.
I don't, because I feel horrible for what I've done, and this may make sense to you as I say it, is that I've walked into an area and seen children die and walk back out. And I said to you before we came on air, we had a 2-minute chat, and I said, I'm sitting here drinking a glass of white wine to calm my nerves. You know, it cost me £5, you know, to buy that bottle of wine. I could have fed 250 kids, you know, and it didn't. I bought a bottle of wine. And I've left children to die who, if I go now, right now, if I just get my passport, if I get some money out of the bank and go now, I can save some of them, and yet I'm sitting here.
There'll be children in other countries that die. There'll be children, you know, in London that will die today. You're not the world's savior. You are a savior.
Tell me about it. Tell me about it. I know. But I know how simple it is to save that child.
I know.
Tell us
what you'd like us to do. How can we help?
Spread the word. You know, I don't mean this in a rude way. Wake up. I want people to wake up to what's going on around them and say, hold on. Do I accept this as okay or not? And if you accept it as okay, that's fine. You know, that's okay. Go on with your life. But if you don't, do something about it. You know,
right.
It's up to us. Each and every one of us, in my view, it's up to us. You know, and without trying, I'm living proof that we can do so much.
You have a program. You have a program that people can purchase. I can't remember what you call it for the year. If you're an angel and a guardian.
Oh yeah, I mean,
tell us about that real quick. We've got 5 minutes left.
Okay, I realized about when the people adopted my charity in February this year. I realized that I was trying to raise £40,000 to feed a million school meals, but that it would only take 84 people paying £20 a month, which is $40 a month. It would take 84 people paying $40 a month, and combined, those 84 people would raise enough money to feed 500,000 school meals in 12 months. And that's something that I'm pushing in the UK at the moment. I'm desperately trying to find 84 supporters who can sign up to the Guardian 84 program, which means they're going to commit £20 a month or $40 a month with the other Guardians. So between us, we can feed 500,000 school meals over the next 12 months.
How do we sign up? I'll sign up. I'll be a Guardian.
If you go onto the website bananaappeal.org,
okay, bananaappeal.org. Mm-hmm.
And then there's a section on Guardian 84 there. There's no standing order mandate online, but if you email from there, I'll physically be able to send you a standing order mandate. I don't know whether it would work for you guys in Canada because of the bank charges coming through. There were people in Holland who wanted to help, but it was costing them more to send the money to me than it was to actually pay the £20. It was going to cost them £25 to send £20.
Yeah, that's silly.
So you may not be able to do it from Canada.
Can we do it through PayPal? You have a PayPal account?
Yeah, you can make donations by PayPal. And again, every $2 would feed 25, or a dollar would feed 12 children for a day.
Right.
You know, $10 would feed 120 children. For a day, you know, and if anybody could do anything, perhaps if they wanted to do something in Canada, have a fundraising event, you know, something like that. That would be magic.
Okay, we'll look at doing that. And Erwin, I'm sure you've got ideas spinning in your head right now, don't you?
I've got the firewall.
I'm thinking about it, and I'm going okay, because one thing you can look at is set up the standing order by PayPal. They pay just by month for $20 or $40 and £20. You can set that up.
Yeah, that may be a very that'd be a great way of doing it. I don't really understand all these. I'm a very simple person, I'm afraid. That might be a great way of doing it.
I'm volunteering Erwin to help you.
Kevin, the simplest thing you do is just contact PayPal. Just contact the support people there, and they will probably be very helpful to set you up and how to do that for the monthly payments.
Right.
I think they're the best people that can do it. Just send in an email and say, listen, I've got that idea. I want to set it up. Can you help me? And they probably will.
Well, there's a wonderful lady who's built all the website for me for free to help the children. So I'll contact her. She may know more about it, and she deals with
it. Let us know, and we'll write about it. I'll write about it on the blog. And then we'll have you come back in a few months' time, and you know, we'll see if we can't push the bananas again.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
Yeah,
I need a Banana Appeal Canada setting up. I need
volunteers. Okay. I hear you.
There's a weight coming on you now, can't you, Frankie?
Oh, I can. All right. Well, I'll definitely see what I can do to further the cause, because I, you know, as a mother and,
yeah.
and you know, a human being, humanitarian,
yeah.
I definitely don't like the thought of a children going to bed hungry, or any child going to bed hungry at night. I know that we waste more food in a day than they eat in a year, probably.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Kevin, thank you so much for being my guest today. You were amazing. You have an incredible story. You're an incredible man. Don't feel guilty. You've done more than many have, and you know, maybe not as much as you'd like, but you've certainly done enough not to feel guilty. You did get off your butt, finally. You know, thank goodness that clicker wasn't in your hand that night, or maybe these kids wouldn't have got fed. But
That's the hardest thing. Actually thinking, what if I hadn't have broken the inhibition to go?
There you go. Yeah.
Horrifying.
I wanted to know, you know, the show, we just officially went off air, but I wanted to know from you, has your wife ever joined you?
No, she won't go for two reasons. Number one, I don't want her to go. You know, it's dangerous over there. There is a high rate of rape. You know, it's not a safe place to go. Number two, we've got two young children of our own, and I would much prefer that Joanne, you know, looked after the children here. I can't be in Zululand looking after kids over there if I feel my own children are in danger. You know, she has found it very difficult as well, Frankie, as you can imagine. If your husband got up and said, look, I'm taking all our money and disappearing for a week, and you don't know where I'm going, and you don't know if I'll come back. You know, it's been a huge stress for her as well. She has no security of a home anymore. I've sold a home from under her. And I've been working really hard just to, you know, extra 10 hours a week trying to feed kids.
She's proud of you, though.
She's one in a million. How many women would let you do that? You know, how many wives would let you do that?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Kevin, can I ask you something?
Yeah, sure.
Because when you talk... Do you believe in the law of attraction?
I watched The Secret about 8 weeks ago, and I never believed in it, other than I'd been experiencing these things, thinking, what on earth is going on? Mm. And it was a horrible experience, you know, not to have anything to put it into perspective with. Do I believe the law of attraction? If I did, every child on this planet would be fed, you know? So even though... I can say to you, incredible things have happened to me that I can't explain, and yes, I can accept that the law of attraction is there, and there's other powers helping me do what I do. I believe that. But if they were as simplistic as the law of attraction, believe me, I put a lot of thought into let's feed these kids, and yet so many still go hungry, and I have that conflict. So I don't know. I don't know. Yes.
Come on. You put a million meals on the table a year, right?
Sorry?
You put at least a million meals on a table a year.
I've fed 400,000 kids on my own, and I've no
doubt
done that. So you,
right.
You
it's amazing.
You have to say something's going on. Something definitely was
exactly,
going on.
Exactly, Kevin. And that's what I'm trying to say also to you. If you feel sorry about and about the whole situation, there's sitting in a glass of wine, you don't appreciate yourself, and you can't even give more. You can love someone else if you love yourself.
That's
how I see it.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Sorry, when Frankie was talking to me, she picks up the anger in my voice and the upset. And people are starting to read the book now and say, look, you're the most incredible man I've ever met. You're really inspirational. You're this, you're that, you're the other. Yet, you know, the reality for me still is when I talk to people about this, I have an incredible emotional link to it. You know, I didn't just get up and think it was a good idea to take all my money and disappear into Zululand. You know, it was incredibly emotional journey for me, and that still comes through today. I still find it difficult to talk about without becoming emotionally involved in it.
Right.
And I hope I stay that way, even if I come across as angry or upset. You know, if I lose that emotional intensity, I'd stop doing it. You know, I don't do it for fun. I didn't sell my house for fun. I wouldn't travel back into Zululand again for fun. And I don't work a part-time job 10 hours a week for fun. You know, I do it because of other things linked to emotion. And I'm sorry if I've sounded angry as I've been speaking.
Oh, no. I think what Irwin is a big fan of the law of attraction.
Right.
And in the law of attraction, by virtue of the fact that you don't feel that you've done enough, you're almost stopping it from happening. So he wants you to be more positive so that you can attract more of what you do want.
I am attracting a lot of people now, and slowly but surely. I'm a very, very impatient man, as you can probably imagine by somebody who just gets up and does things like that.
Yep.
I'm an action man. I take action. My heart's bigger than my brain. I don't stop to think about things. I do. You know, if something's happening, I just do it and then think, oh, I shouldn't have done that later on. You know, and that's the way I am, but I can't change. But I am starting to attract people now. And even though I'm very responsive and take action, I've realized that a lot of things that have happened and caused me pain over the last 2 years had to happen. I had to get up and go and find Snee and help him. I had to then go through the pain of being on my own to do all these things. Because if I hadn't have been on my own, it wouldn't be inspirational. It would just be another charity doing good work. And I think now, really, people, even though I really can't see it, and I don't say that in a humble way, I really can't see what's inspirational about what I've done. I find it, you know, quite horrible of what I've been through and what I've had to do and what I've seen. I don't feel inspirational, but I know other people do. And I see all the pieces of the jigsaw on a cosmic level falling into place. And I believe now that it's not the law of attraction that's stopping me because I'm not being positive. I think it's running its own course. If I had to come on your show and said I found one kid and then I fed 10 others, it wouldn't have meant anything. I've had to have gone through all this for people to take attention. I had to sell my house and take on a part-time job for 2 years and feed 400,000 kids on my own, thinking, good God, where is everybody else? Why aren't they helping? Because the law of attraction was saying, this is what this place needs. It needs you to be the person that people will go, wow, how can some ordinary idiot do that? That's amazing.
Well, you are the epitome of unstoppable. And not only that, you... yeah, you are. You're the epitome of unstoppable. And that is, to me... Yeah, what I find very attractive about it all. But you're right. I mean, we are all, and that's what I do is I try to show people that we're all incredible, extraordinary beings in an ordinary body. And we all have that capacity to do what you've done. Not everybody's going to do it because they don't all have the courage or the gumption or whatever it is that it takes to do it.
It's not courage.
They have it there.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be being sick in the toilet, believe me.
No, because that's what courage is. Courage is getting up and facing the fear, even if you're puking your guts out in the toilet, you know, you're still getting on that plane, you're still going there and doing what it is that you do, knowing that you may not go home to your family.
Yeah.
And that is what courage is. That's not fear, that's courage. Courage is doing it anyway.
It's courage if you come back safely, but if you don't, it's stupidity.
No, you still accomplished a lot. You still accomplished a lot.
Exactly.
But you know what? I don't want you to spend any more money on the phone because that's money that, you know, these kids are going
to... If I could just say to Edwin before I go, the Law of Attraction, my book had come out for a week and all these incredible things started to happen. You may have may not heard of some of these people. But Deepak Chopra was given a copy of the book in Singapore while he was on tour there about a week ago. Richard Branson, who's an entrepreneur in the UK, may not be as famous in the US or Canada as he is. He's being given a copy of the book. Bill Clinton is being presented a copy with the book.
Excellent.
You know, John DeMartini, have you heard of him?
Yeah.
Inspirational speaker in the US. He's being given a copy of the book. And a guy who wrote the book, Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Yeah.
He's getting a copy of the book as well. And how, why? You know, I don't know. I don't know where this is all going. You know, it's got a life of its own.
Because you initiated actually something, and that's a vibration you send out.
Yeah.
And that vibration is catched. And that's why. It's why, for example, because Frank is a coach and I'm a coach myself.
Right.
I always tell people, if you want to achieve something or do something, write it down. when you write it down, and you really send out a vibration. And you, by writing that book, you just send out that good vibration that you want to go, and that accelerated from gear one to gear six, I think.
I see
and
everything.
Deepak Remark, Victor Hansen, they're all connected. Those guys are all connected to one another. And, you know, this is going to be a movie. You are going to be a movie. I know it. Somebody's going to write that screenplay. Maybe, I don't know, but you're a movie. You're a movie of the week, at least.
Listen, Frankie, people can do what they want. I'm just going to go and keep feeding kids. If they follow magic, and if they don't, I'll just carry on.
Kevin. God bless you.
Thanks for having me on your show.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
You take care of yourself.
Bye. Bye. Thank you. Bye, Kevin.
Bye.
Bye, Kevin.
Bye.
Bye.